Welcome to episode 54 of Tucker Center Talks with me, your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie. This week, Anna Gorovich and I talk with Dr. Zini Ofebu about her research on exploitation, misogynoir, experience, and identities of Black women athletes, coaches, and administrators in higher education. This is an episode you won't want to miss. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center, a first-of-its-kind, world-class research center and thought leader around girls and women in sport. Tucker Center Talks is a place where I talk to, amplify, and support my colleagues, amazing women who study sport and gender. So let's talk. In this podcast, Anna and I are talking to Zini Ofebu. Dr. Ofebu is an assistant professor of educational leadership at Santa Clara University. Her research focuses on issues of social justice in college athletics and higher ed, the schooling experience of Black immigrant students, and broader issues of equity and inclusion in higher ed. In one line of her research, which we are very excited to talk to her about, she uses Black feminist thought and a multi-level framework to explore the exploitation experiences and identities of Black women athletes. We are so excited to talk to you. Welcome, Dr. Ofebu.
Yes. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to have a conversation about my work and just issues of gender in sport. So thank you for the invitation.
You are very welcome. Your one of your more recent articles, which we'll talk about today, has been circulating the Tucker team. So we have been excited to get you on the podcast. So before we get started, give us a brief career pathway and how you landed on this line of inquiry.
Yeah. So I should start by saying I'm not an athlete. I get the question a lot when I tell folks that I study college athletics. I wasn't an athlete. I have no athletic ability. I can barely dribble a ball. I can barely shoot a ball. I'm tall, but that's about it. But not an athlete at all. But I started working in college athletics as an undergraduate student. I did event management for my athletic department at San Diego State, where I got my my first degree. And it was there that I really just got immersed in the college sports environments, working different football games, basketball, softball, baseball, and was just really intrigued by and excited by just the environment that sports create and how folks come together to, you know, root for and cheer for, you know, a common goal of winning and beating the other guy or the other, you know, the other folks. And I transitioned to a student facing role as a graduate student when I was getting my master's degree. And during that time, I worked with football players, volleyball players, women's basketball players on the academic side of things, doing some academic mentoring and advising. And through different conversations that I was having with my Black athletes in particular, I started to realize that there's so much that we don't understand about the college athlete experience. And when you add the, you know, racial identity, gender identity, sexuality to those experiences, it creates even more of a nuance to what these athletes might be experiencing in team settings, in the classroom, in their competitive fields when they're playing their sport or competing in their sport, on social media, right? So I had some questions about how these different isms and systems of power, oppression, all of the things might be informing the ways that they experience these different athletic and academic environments. And I wanted to understand that more, which led me to pursue my PhD at NC State. And I started to ask some questions about what does it mean to be a Black woman in this space? What does it mean to be a Black woman athlete? And really trying to understand how these different identities that they hold might be shaping the relationships that they're building with their teammates and their coaches and other athletes in their athletic department, and how ultimately they're making sense of their Black womanhood within these Division I predominantly white athletic contexts.
Wow, that's a lot to unpack. And thank you for the good work that you're doing. We have just been thinking about doing some similar work to what you're doing, but at the youth level, with high school and youth athletes, with experience of girls of color on predominantly white teams and how that can inform our coaching her curriculum. But tell us a little more specifically about your work as it relates to gender and sport with Black female athletes And then we might have, well, I'm sure we'll have some follow-up questions.
So I like to think my work being situated as like being a higher education scholar, right? I was socialized as a higher education and student affairs scholar. And I just happened to study this one aspect of higher education in college athletics that is in itself its own kind of field of study. So I like to think that my work exists at the intersections of sport and education. And I'm presently trying to make sense of the experiences of Black women athletes, coaches, professionals, administrators, and what their experiences and perspectives are as it relates to exploitation and these larger conversations about exploitation in college sports. Oftentimes, there's a lot of scholarly discourse, a lot of public discourse about exploitation, right? College athletes are exploited. Folks are making millions of dollars off of their backs. Schools are making millions of dollars off of their backs. And the folks who are making the money are predominantly white, right? So there's a lot of discourse around that reality of college sports, particularly at the Division I Power Five. I'm going to call her Power Five because her mom named her Power Five. At the Power Five level, but oftentimes that discourse centers basketball and football, which makes sense, right? Because at most institutions, those are the two sports that make the most money. But when we center those two sports, we're inherently centering men in the conversation, right? And Black men in particular, and kind of creating this narrative that Black men are being exploited. Black men are the only folks who are being exploited in these highly commercialized college athletic settings. And I think there's something very unique about the ways that gendered racism in particular and the ideologies associated with gender racism might inform the way Black women are experiencing these spaces and how they're experiencing exploitation. It might inform the ways that, you know, other folks who have these historically marginalized backgrounds and identities are experiencing exploitation in these different settings, particularly in their relationships with coaches, with teammates, with colleagues, et cetera, et cetera. So what I've been trying to make sense of in different conversations with current and former Black athletes, Black women athletes, current and former Black women coaches and professionals at the Division I level is what does interpersonal exploitation look like? What does exploitation that occurs in these interpersonal relationships that Black women have in order to navigate the athletic space, the college athletic space, what role does that play in informing larger patterns of labor and economic exploitation in college athletics? And then ultimately, how do these different forms of exploitation keep college athletics running like a well-oiled machine, right? Because it's working for the majority of folks, or it's working for the folks who are making money, but oftentimes it's not making sense or working for the folks who are, you know, experiencing microaggressions and stereotypes in their relationships with teammates or coaches or their supervisors or their colleagues. So how do we kind of, or my thinking about it is, how do we kind of get to the root of the issue, right? Which is the relationships and the different ideologies that are informing the relationships.
Yeah, the sticky problem, the wicked problem. It's to keep unpacking it, and there's different layers.
And your 2024 recently published SSJ Sports Sociology Journal piece on this particular like theoretical framing of integrating Black feminist thought and interpersonal exploitation, which I recommend for all our listeners to go read immediately after after this conversation.
Agree.
We'll link it in the show notes. We'll ask Lindsay to help us with that. And I found it so useful because I also think, in addition to some of the gaps that you just addressed with just the dominance of this type of scholarship around Black male athletes in football and basketball, and that focus on the economic exploitation at that very high structural level, I thought it was really cool how you integrated just the centralizing of Black women's voices and the interpersonal exploitation that they face as also like just addressing that gap in research. And I wanted to know if you could speak a bit more of how this interpersonal framework adds to or expands on previous work about Black sportswomen and Black coaches and Black administrators, and how you hope to use this type of framework in the future.
In many ways, I laugh because the paper that was published looked completely different even a year ago, and it was really the peer review process that got it to where it is today. Or not today, because today I feel like it looks different than it did when I published it a couple of months ago. But I say that to say, shout out to the Sociology of Sport Journal editorial board and reviewers, because this paper and this concept wouldn't be what it is, that what wouldn't be what folks are able to read without the really developmental feedback that I got during that process. But yeah, I say all that to say, in many ways, I think interpersonal exploitation as an analytical frame really leverages the work of scholars like Akil Carter-Franzen, Tamika Ferguson, folks who have been studying Black women for the last decade, right? And really trying to unpack what does it look like to be a Black woman athlete in these spaces? What do Black women athletes need in terms of building a sense of belonging, in terms of building community, in terms of persisting and resisting these dominant narratives that, because just because we're not talking about Black women means that they're doing just fine, when most of the time that's not the case. So I think it builds on and leverages that work. I don't think it would have been possible to even think about what exploitation looks like for Black women without the scholarship that has, that has been published in the last 10 or so years. And I'm thinking specifically about Akilah Carter-Franzen's work, leveraging ethic of care, right, to understand Black women athletes' sense of belonging and how that is inherently formed by Patricia Hill Collins' work on Black feminist thought, right? And that really undergirds the way that I'm making sense of why exploitation is bad, right, and what it looks like for Black women. So yeah, I say all that to say, I think it adds another lens of understanding why Black women approach building community on their in team settings a certain way, right? Why Black women approach different relationships, and even the way that they're thinking about why they're a college athlete, right? And why, how they're thinking about what do I need to do to persist in this space that I have to be in if I want to play my sport, right? So a long-winded way of saying my work is not possible without the work of others, right? And I hope that folks engage with my work, absolutely. But in doing that, I hope that it prompts folks to engage with the work that informed it, right? Because my stuff wouldn't be here without the stuff of others that I've been citing for the last 5 or so years.
Yeah, we say this often on the Tucker Center talks and in the Tucker Center is no good work happens alone. So all of our work builds on the shoulders of others. So thank you for recognizing that. And I really, what I loved about your piece in SSJ was the chrono system piece of how do we think about like using Bronfenbrenner's ecological model with that chronicity piece over time is how does exploitation inform from the past to the present? What does that arc look like over time? And how does the intensity and the frequency of microaggressions and, all the things in the system over time, how does that impact Black female athletes? I really like that piece.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think it's an important consideration just thinking about, the passage of Title IX 52 years ago, right? And how there's an assumption that because, women's access to college sports increased, that must mean that, Black women's access to college sports increased, right? But when you think about it from a chronological perspective, like, yes, it's possible that that increase incurred, but also how have other, societal factors, political factors also changed to create experiences that are unique for Black women athletes across time, right? 10 years ago, the impact of social media, we might not be having a conversation about how Black women athletes or athletes in general's experiences are impacted by social media because of the prevalence of social media over the last, I would say, the last 5 years, even. That's a reality, that we kind of have to add to that conversation, right? So yeah, just to kind of echo, I think it's important to consider how that changes this kind of cycle of time informs the way that folks are experiencing these different environments.
And I feel like something that I listening to hear you speak about this now, and something that I was thinking about when reading the piece and talking about others is just how the connection between interpersonal relationships at all these different micro, meso, macro levels, and then connecting that to the structural piece in ways that are typically kind of veiled or erased by this collegiate capitalist machine and focus on money. And so I think I really thought it was so amazing how you just kind of highlighted those interpersonal aspects of just the day-to-day exploitation that Black women athletes have to face, Black women coaches have to face on so many different levels. And then how can we structurally find ways to change those types of systems? So yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot. And I think you ask a lot of questions and of the field itself of how can we kind of do research in ways that center people's voices and meanings in a lot more productive ways.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think I've been grappling with some of those questions too, of, now that I wrote the thing or that we're talking about the thing, how do we change the thing, right? Or how do we ask questions that not only take a multi-level approach to understanding organizational cultures and their impact on Black women's experience, et cetera, but are we at the stage where the only solution is to burn it down and start over? And is that a reality? I don't know that that's possible, right? But hopefully that piece will get folks asking questions about, okay, what can we do with what we have, right? Or what can we do with the people that we have in our organizations? Who do we need to get rid of? What values do we need to change, right? How do we be better? How can we be better, right? And that's ultimately, I think, what I want folks to walk away with, right? Like, now that we know, what can we do about it?
Yeah, we're big proponents of doing something with one's research. How does it impact change at whatever level of the system or all the levels? But you don't just do research to do research. And, yes, we sometimes do that, but we like to do things. I'm going to ask maybe a hard question, but what out of this model that you've proposed about exploitation identities of Black female athletes, what have you found is the sticky idea in this? Like, what do people grab onto and go, ooh, yeah, that's, I like that.
Yeah. I think so. Two things. I think in different conversations that I've had with Black women professionals in particular, a lot of times we'll start a conversation talking about, what is exploitation? What does exploitation look like? What are your thoughts on exploitation? And we'll often talk about athletes, right? And how athletes are exploited. And what I'm finding is that folks, even professionals in this space, don't realize that they've been exploited until they have the language to really say, like, oh, that's what it was, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think anybody enters a relationship with an employee or with a colleague with the intention of exploiting them. However, when we use our power to control somebody or restrict their access to a promotion or tenure or a professional development opportunity, that's inherently exploited. And I think the really sticky aspect of my research is that exploitation, interpersonal exploitation, is not unique to college athletics. It happens across higher education and academia, in corporate America, when Black women and other similarly marginalized folks are tokenized for diversity purposes. It happens when folks are denied tenure or promotions or different opportunities that they are qualified for and oftentimes overqualified for.
Or don't get elected to the US presidency.
Exactly. So to that point, right, like, it's more than just a discipline specific, field specific concept, right? It's something that occurs, for all of our eyes to see, and we just don't have the language to say, like, oh, that's what it is. Like, this is what this thing is. And I hate to talk about the election, but I remember when, the tide turned in July, I remember saying to someone, we're about to see just how much America hates Black women. And I think at the organizational level in sport organizations and higher education in corporate America, that kind of misogynoir informs who's hired, it informs who's promoted, it informs who we define as being an effective leader and who is not, right? And all of that is exploited. It's all of that is exploitive, right? So I think that's really what I want folks to walk away from this paper in particular with. Like, what does interpersonal exploitation look like in my life? What might it look like in my organization? And how do I change these exploitive cultures, right? Or how do I, give voice or space or even amplify my own experiences so that folks know the ways in which these cultures are harmful to myself and others?
Do you find, I'm just thinking about when I talk to, and this is not a gender race intersectional thought right now, but I'm wondering when I talk to women coaches who have been coaching for 20, 25 plus years about their experiences of microaggressions and sexism and or racism or the intersection of that, many of these women are like, I don't, that's never happened to me. I don't know what you're talking about. Does that happen at the intersection of gender and race in your work, or is this a universal, like, I absolutely know exactly what you're talking about, and I can explain 20 examples of it?
Yeah, I would definitely say it happens in my work as well. So, for example, the study that I'm working on, listening to Black women's athletes, coaches, experiences with exploitation. A lot of times I'll ask a question like, who are those folks in your athletic department who are supportive? Who are those folks who are not supportive? And when we're talking about the folks who are not supportive, I'm actively hearing stories of exploitation that folks may not have realized or reflected on enough to say, like, oh, that's, when that person said XYZ, or when this person treated me a certain way, that's what they were communicating to me, right? And I think it goes back to like not having the language to describe what you're experiencing, because I've heard exploitation just dripping from so many stories. But if I repeated that story back to, that same person and said it was somebody else, they would probably be able to recognize like, oh, that was bad, right? But because it's your own experience, I think sometimes it takes a while and having a conversation with someone maybe who's not familiar with the space to say like that wasn't good, right? Or that was problematic behavior. And admittedly, that's something, that I've experienced myself, right? Repeating back something that I experienced to someone and kind of listening to it, like, huh, I think that was a microaggression. So yeah, I think it's common. I think it's the way that women are socialized in particular that kind of, I don't want to say it makes us ignorant to it. I think it makes us less aware of it as it's happening until we repeat it back to someone else and are able to say like, oh, that is what it was. And I think that's the fun part about microaggressions in particular is like, you don't, it's so micro. It could be so small, it could be so subtle that you don't realize like that was racism until you've had the time to kind of sit back and realize like, oh, that was a problematic racist or sexist comment that was made.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking about that, like it's in a way kind of like ignorance by design of like the system wants us to be ignorant of these types of microaggressions because it works for some people and those people that are in power don't want that system to change at all. And so I'm really excited to hear more about like how you're kind of working through that in this space. I feel like ignorance by design maybe isn't like the best way to put it, or maybe like a coping mechanism or something that's internalized of how to kind of navigate these racialized and gendered systems. I don't know, if you have any initial thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely a coping mechanism. I think it's a coping me mechanism. I think it's a survival mechanism. I think oftentimes women in particular, especially women in leadership, and I'll use my scholarship as an example. I think Black women in particular are often just thankful to be in the space, right? Because there are not a lot of leadership opportunities that are available to women in general, right? So when we achieve those upper echelons of administration, I think oftentimes we may feel this need to kind of, not to rock the boat, right? Like even if you're experiencing something harmful or problematic, kind of internalizing it instead of externalizing it and saying, hey, that was not right. Could you do something different? Right. So I think it's a coping strategy to kind of navigate the different things, but I think it's ultimately a survival mechanism, right? I'm going to put up with this in this space because I know I want to stay in this space, or because I know I want to advance in this space. So I'm going to do whatever I can do to survive, even if that comes at the expense of my mental or physical health. which is what many of the women that I've talked to experienced, right? Coping, feeling like it was their responsibility to maintain the harmony of their team or maintain harmony with colleagues who were problematic or saying problematic things because they wanted to stay in that in the space, right? They wanted to continue to have access to the space. But yeah, that's no fault of their own. I think it's a natural response, right? Especially when you've worked so hard to be somewhere. But I think again, it's like it's by design, right? Like these are the ways that these spaces inherently, they were built to make us feel, right? So we internalize that.
It's like this, I don't know if I'm going to articulate this the right way, but it's the fine line between disruption and survival. And how do you navigate that? Because, what are the alternatives and consequences on either side? It's neither way. Nobody gets out scot-free. Yeah, interesting.
So you mentioned the project you're working on right now around Black women athletes and Black women coaches, administrators, etc. So I want to know if you can talk about more about that or anything else that you're really excited that you're working on right now, you're really excited about.
I'm really excited about this study that I'm working on with Black women coaches and administrators. One, because it's my first time having conversations with administrators and coaches in an intentional way. Prior to this study, a lot of my research focused on athletes, right? And it still does. But I think bringing in being inclusive of Black women, regardless of what role they hold in athletics, is just adding a much richer understanding of what it's like to be a Black woman in these spaces and how exploitation and really dehumanization looks like across whatever role folks take on in the space. So something that I'm really fascinated by at the moment are these concepts related to care and other mothering that Black women take on in these spaces. What I'm finding and it's currently kind of making sense of in my research is how Black women professionals in particular are often expected to care for others, right? Care for Black athletes, care for their staff in these really meaningful ways. And then on the flip side of that, they're punished for that care, right? And they're told that, it's not, you're not demonstrating effective leadership because you're caring for your students or your staff in these ways. Or the ways that you're caring and the ways that you're speaking up and advocating for students are detrimental to the machine, right? You're questioning the machine too much in the ways that you're caring, right? So that's something that I'm making sense of, and something that I did not anticipate when I started this study, but it's come up in an overwhelming amount of my conversation, particularly with Black women who are not even in student-facing roles, right? So they're taking on these care responsibilities, even though they work in media relations or they work in business affairs. Black athletes, Black staff are still finding them and really leaning on them to care for them in these spaces. And they're choosing to care for them as well. But in making that choice, they're often punished for it, right? So it's like this damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. So yeah, that's something I'm still kind of sifting through and making sense of. What does care look like and how are Black women punished for caring?
That reminds me of the work of Susan Fiske and Stereotype Threat Model, which I don't know her work well enough to know if there's a racial layer on that. But what you're just describing is how women have to balance this care and likability and nurturing and, conforming to a traditional feminine norm, because that's what we do, versus being perceived as competent. And if you're too caring, you're not perceived as doing your job, or you're incompetent, or you're too feminine, you're too nurturing. And then if you do, and also on the other side of that, if you do the caring, it has its toll on you. With your emotional labor that takes to care for others in people-facing roles. And then if you're not caring, you're criticized because you're not conforming to your traditional feminine role. And then I'm with the racialized layer, then you're just the angry black woman. So I'm wondering if that stereotype threat model would be informative to some of the thinking that you're doing in that work.
I absolutely think it is. And just as you were speaking, I was thinking about this concept of mammification, right? That's informed by the mammy caricature, right? The black woman as the loyal servant, the dutiful caretaker who is deferential to white authority, right? And how that may inform the ways the how that might inform the ways that black folk or black or that black women are thought of as leaders, right? There are only three black women athletic directors at the Power Five level, right? There are so few I can name them, right? At the University of Virginia, Vanderbilt, and Duke University, right? And I think a lot of that has to do with this belief that Black women are not meant to be in leadership roles. They're meant to be in these service and support roles, right? They're meant to support the leadership, not be the leadership. And I think some of that, some that stereotype and some of that ideology might inform one, Black women's lack of access to leadership roles, but also this expectation that regardless of the role that they have in within the organization, they are engaging in some kind of emotional labor. They're engaging in some kind of caretaking, whether it is caretaking for staff, whether it's caretaking for leadership, whether it's caretaking for students. There's this expectation. To see to your point, right? When that expectation is not being met, they're punished. When that expectation is being exceeded, they're punished, right? So it's like, how do you navigate these different ideological beliefs that are informing the ways people perceive you in this space, while also, caring for people in ways that are affirming, in ways that are relevant, in ways that might be true to who you are just as a human being outside of work, right? How do you kind of balance all of the things?
And the real need that athletes need this support, especially Black athletes, marginalized athletes, because the systems aren't giving them any of this type of support to begin with. And so it's kind of like our Black, this labor then, of course, falls on Black women and administrators and coaches to fill in the gaps that the system is failing to have to support athletes. But yeah, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's like, how do you, because if you don't do it,
Who will?
who will?
Yeah, and then that's a whole nother cascade of consequences for the student athlete, which is what we don't want.
So going in circles and circles of frustrating spirals.
Systems of oppression that we're all grappling with.
Working as they do. I wanted to transition us to asking you about some advice that you could give to young women scholars and researchers and folks in this field.
Yeah, I think some of the biggest pieces of advice would just be to keep asking disruptive questions, right? Keep challenging and critiquing structures, norms, traditions, those gendered, ideologies that say that you don't belong here. You shouldn't be asking these questions, or you shouldn't be challenging the system in this way. You don't have to prove anything to anyone but yourself. And as long as you're happy with the work that you're doing, that's what matters. And then also, I think it's important to recognize our stake in the work that we do and recognize what stake we have in the questions that we ask. For me, being a Black woman, I am very, very personally and professionally invested in my work and the outcomes of the folks that I study and am in community with, right? So for me, this work that I do in athletics, it inherently informs the work and the ways that I exist in academia, right? It will inherently inform, my tenure chances, right? When it's time for me to go up for tenure. And just being, being a Black woman who is a lover of other Black women and a carer for other Black women, I feel personally invested in what happens to us, right? So regardless of who you study, what questions you ask, I think it's important to recognize, like, what do I have to lose or what do I have to gain when asking these questions? So yeah, I think that's probably the biggest piece of advice. I think we should all be personally invested in our work in some way. So realizing what that personal investment is, and then being intentional in taking care of yourself after you realize that investment.
Yes.
I think being so close to this work, I think oftentimes it's easy to get triggered by some of the things that I hear in conversations that I have with folks, because they mirror my experience in life and academia. So, yes, recognize the personal stake, but also recognize when it's time to take a step back and affirm other aspects of your identity and take care of yourself.
That is very refreshing because I feel like as someone who's PhD student, early career researcher, scholar, like the norm is of course in this type of work to like be objective and don't do me search, quote unquote. And it's I think that is really powerful to remind us of like we're doing this for a reason, and the reason is because we care about the communities that we care about and wanting to make people's lives better, and that is intrinsically tied to our identities as well. So thank you for that reminder.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I think all work should be me search. I am an unapologetic me searcher. I'm a Black woman,
Yes.
an immigrant origin, right? I have come from an immigrant background. All of my work is me search, right? Because someone was doing the work for me, right? And these spaces that I inhabit are that way because someone was asking critical questions about what might it look like for students like me, professionals like me, to experience these environments better. So I see it as kind of paying it forward, right?
Yes.
Yes, I'm doing this research on folks who experience environments like me, but I'm doing it for them, not for myself.
Yep.
I love it.
I like this unapologetic me searcher.
Yeah.
You heard it here first on Tucker Center Talks.
I love that.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Okay. So, really great advice. And I would argue that the work that you are doing right now is very much needed and very important. And for those listening, this is a safe community of scholars who care deeply about these issues and to take care of yourself, but also to take care of each other. And that's a space that we are aspiring to create here on Tucker Center Talks. So we're going to end with a fun speed round of questions. There's three of them. And there's no right or wrong answer. And you, whatever you pops to your mind is your answer. All right. So what is at the top of your playlist right now?
Beyonce.
Okay.
Oh,
Go Beyoncé, the hive unites. Okay, who is your favorite badass woman right now?
Beyonce.
Yes.
I was wondering if she was going to come out again.
The most Grammy nominations ever, right? I think after this last round. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, now if you pick Beyoncé for this next answer, this might be a hot take, so we'll see what you come up with. What gender or sports scholar has influenced your work the most currently?
Akilah Carter-Franzik.
Yeah, Keela, one of my faves. Her work is great. Okay, well, that is a wrap for this episode of Tucker Center Talks. Be sure to check out our evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on X, Facebook, or Instagram. Thank you for being our guest here today, Dr. Ofebu. We love your work and we're big fans. Thank you to our producer and Tucker team member, Lindsay Hofer, and thank you for listening to Tucker Center Talks. As we wrap, support others and let data tell the story and be an unapologetic me searcher. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie.
And I'm Anna Gorvitch.
And we are signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.